I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. All right, a little story. Last summer, my family and I, we knew we were really lucky because in the midst of a deadly global pandemic, we had a home, jobs we could do remotely, and secure health insurance. Also, rather incredibly, we had a brilliant millennial with an elementary education degree who had just rented our guest house. So under these circumstances, I definitely didn't feel like I could do a lot of quarantine complaining. Still, like so many others, our crew felt isolated. We felt the loss of long-anticipated moments, like that moment when my eldest daughter graduated high school in our living room. And all of us spiraled with grief and rage when Breonna Taylor was killed in her own bed, and Ahmaud Arbery was hunted and shot, and when George Floyd was murdered in broad daylight. So, facing a summer, last summer, without camps or travel or even playdates, I knew I had to do something to counter this world of illness, death, and loss that was threatening to consume us. And that is when I launched our family's Black Joy Camp. Together, our family,
James,
Parker,
Anna,
Melissa, created a 10-week plan to get us through the summer. We focused on topics like sports, stories, art, music, science, robotics, and yes, social change. All right, so again, it's our first day of camp, and we're doing sports today, remember?
Yeah.
And what is the theme of our camp?
Black joy.
Black joy. And again, what does joy mean to you?
Love, peace, and happiness.
Love, peace, and happiness. So, our sports camp, where we're going to have love, peace, and happiness, one of the things we have to have is healthy bodies. Healthy bodies that do fun things. So today, we're going to stretch, we're going to run, we're going to drink some water.
We read books about Mae Jemison, Shirley Chisholm, and Simone Biles. We memorized Nikki Giovanni poetry and learned how to spot a Basquiat painting. Brianna led our Black girl yoga every morning, and my daughters had parent-free sister time every afternoon. During Music Week, we listened to Ella Fitzgerald.
Yeah. Ooh, I know a music song.
Tell me a music song.
A duet.
Can't you see it's love?
Well, you don't sound like Ella Fitzgerald, that's for sure.
I was doing a duet.
Okay. Do you remember when Ella Fitzgerald said, accentuate the positive and eliminate the negative?
Yes.
And what did that mean?
Good things bigger, bad things smaller.
You got it.
And during Feel Good Week, we got intentional about loving the beautiful Black selves we see in the mirror.
And what about your face? What do you see when you look at Anna's face?
He looks beautiful.
It does? I think so too. Do you love yourself? How much?
100%.
Grandpa Perry led a Zoom session about James Weldon Johnson, and Cousin Chris taught us basketball moves virtually. We made vision boards and we wrote our very own storybook. It was called Cupcake's Birthday.
They jump on the trampoline and on the slide. Cupcake goes first because she is a birthday girl.
We walked barefoot in the grass, chalked the driveway, and every single day, we consciously cultivated joy. And now I'm happy to welcome Badia Ahad Lagardi. She's professor and vice provost for faculty affairs at Loyola University Chicago. She's also the author of Afro-Nostalgia, Feeling Good in Contemporary Black Culture. Badia, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I was raised in a Black Southern tradition that distinguished between joy and happiness. Do you make this distinction?
You know, I see them rather synonymously, I have to say, but joy is something that I think is really broad. And especially when we think about Black joy, I like to link it to the psychological. So that might be the distinction that I make. Happiness is more of an emotional feeling, and joy, I think, is really tied to the psychological.
So I spent a lot of time last night in this book, in Afro-Nostalgia, and
Oh, I loved how you articulated these kind of critical ideas about nostalgia and joy, and particularly how they connect with contemporary Black experiences and historical ones. So make that connection for our listeners. What is that connection between nostalgia and joy?
You know, nostalgia has enjoyed a rather recent renaissance, especially in psychology. And what a lot of recent studies have found is that nostalgia is really crucial to cultivating joy. So it's an emotion that encourages feelings of belonging. It contributes to feelings of self-worth. It gives us a sense of hope and optimism for the future, which is really interesting because usually people think about nostalgia in terms of the past, but really nostalgia does a lot in the way of giving us a sense of possibility for what lies ahead. And it also promotes feelings of joy and self-esteem.
I kept thinking the two things that created such collective joy in the context of the quarantine for COVID-19 was club quarantine, right? Where suddenly we realized, oh, not only do we need to be together, but we needed to be together in this kind of musically nostalgic way. And then also verses, right? Which brings back all the, you know, the old groups to battle each other sonically. And I just thought, yeah, there it is. There's Black nostalgia and Black joy together.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, what's really important about that is to pay attention to the creative process, right? So really Black people doing what we've always done in really difficult circumstances, which is to create, to be in community, to cultivate joy. And so I think that those examples that you just named are perfect.
So how, though, do we connect our memories, particularly our collective memories of trauma, so many of which were reproduced in this difficult year, and yet also the idea of nostalgia and of memory being a space of joy and happiness?
Sure. So, you know, I would certainly never suggest that, you know, we ignore, right, the harsh realities of the moment and certainly the circumstances of the past, especially that kind of narrative of trauma that I think we know so well. But I think it's also really important to be mindful that there are other aspects of Black life that allow us to cope with those difficult moments and really withstand those difficult circumstances. So for me, Black joy really functions as a form of resistance, and it's really central to our own survivability.
All right. So let's talk about some specific aspects of Black joy, like practices, things we can do. What is the Knapp Ministry?
Oh, well, the Knapp Ministry. So Tricia Hersey is the founder and self-proclaimed bishop of the Knapp Ministry, and she's a visual artist. But I would say that she's so much more than that. She's someone who basically suggests that because African Americans or enslaved ancestors were robbed of their ability to sleep at will and thus deprived of their ability to dream, that as a form of reparations, contemporary Black folks should actually really embrace rest and leisure and pleasure and all the things that our enslaved ancestors were denied. So that is her ministry, and she does a wonderful job of creating spaces of rest.
It's funny, when I first encountered that thought, I was like, oh, of any form of resistance, I can surely do this. But then it turns out it's quite a bit harder than I expected, that being intentional about resting is maybe the thing I'm least good at.
Yeah, I think it is. Especially just with so much going on and so much that has gone on, especially within the past year, it's been very difficult to attempt to even escape the bustle of the day and all of the, you know, series of news events, especially the negative news events that come across our social media feeds and our radios and our televisions on a daily basis. But it's also so central, I think, to be very intentional about self-care in these moments. And I, you know, love seeing the renaissance of Audre Lorde and, you know, promoting self-care as a form of resistance, right? And it's not something that we should take for granted, but it's something that we should take ownership of. And I think that's really at the core of Hersey's work as well. But, you know, I've actually really loved watching other people engage in acts of joy. So that's been, you know, a source of joy for me as well.
Tell me about that.
You know, I was just thinking about how I, you know, I'm on social media a lot, I have to say, probably more than I should be. So, you know, I'm on Instagram and I love seeing, you know, Eve Ewing, who's a scholar that I just really admire. She's on Instagram baking bread. You know, I've recently started following Alexis Nicole, and she's a Black forager, and she does things like candy pine cones and make scones out of dandelions and things like that. It's just so fascinating to watch people really be creative and really be out in the world and just doing the things that they enjoy and that they love. And that really brings me joy as well. And just full disclosure, I'm a golfer and the weather's finally turned nice in Chicago. So I've been doing a lot of that. And it's always nice watching Troy Mullins, who's one of my favorite golfers, one of the few Black women golfers, really do her thing on the circuit. So that's been fun to watch too.
So, Badia, in that moment, you were so incredibly generous thinking about your own joy connected to these experiences of just watching others in their moment of joy. But one of the things I must say I loved about the book was that you also talk about the affective power of the petty. And I must say, I do get a little bit of joy from hanging out in Petty Corner. What do you mean by the affective power of the petty, especially as we're looking back, right, historically?
Sure. So that chapter is really about the ways in which, it's really about historical novels of slavery, right? And how contemporary writers have attempted to enact justice through literature for the their enslaved ancestors, I would say. And, you know, what's really powerful to me in those texts is that, you know, not every act of resistance was about, you know, fighting back physically or running away from the plantation, so to speak, but really about paying attention to the emotional slights or the ways in which people were deceptive. And I think Angela Davis actually talks about this a little bit in one of her essays, in that sometimes enslaved people practiced resistance by just slowing down their work pace or, you know, doing certain things to just resist their contemporary circumstances. And so that's what I kind of linked to the petty in that particular chapter.
Badia Ahad Lagardi is an associate professor and vice provost for faculty affairs at Loyola University Chicago. Last summer's global protests against white supremacy and systemic racism led to institutions from corporate America to municipal police, colleges and universities, philanthropies and media organizations, all to take stock of how race and inequality manifest in their work. And this included museums. Now, some museums are reckoning with their past in very tangible ways. This April, in a historic move, Germany announced it would return stolen artifacts currently in its museums back to Nigeria, including the priceless Benin bronzes of the then Kingdom of Benin. And in March, the University of Aberdeen in Scotland agreed to repatriate its Benin bronze. France also indicated similar plans this year. Yet some museums, including the famed British Museum and the Metropolitan Museum of Art, have not committed to doing the same, despite having sizable collections of looted objects, including Benin bronzes. For more on this, we're joined by Karen Atiyah. She is Global Opinions Editor at The Washington Post. Karen, always good to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. And also with us is Chika Okeke-Agolo, who is professor at Princeton University in the Department of Art and Archaeology and the Department of African American Studies. Chika, also thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Karen, let's just start with why some of these museums in Europe have announced that they're returning these artifacts. How have they been framing this decision?
So, obviously, the latest, as you mentioned in your intro, Germany has pledged to return the Benin, its collections of the Benin bronzes back to Nigeria. And the framing was of basically of a almost of a moral obligation to do so. And it's interesting that we're even talking about this right now when it comes to Germany's history and past in Africa. It also, just over the past weekend, has agreed to pay out some 1 billion euros to those that it colonized in Namibia. But it's really this reckoning with the sourcing, with the history, with the violence of how these objects were stolen in these punitive, violent raids in the Kingdom of Benin. So it's been really intriguing to see Germany really taking this lead, and we do have to note that it's also because Nigeria has basically agreed to they're constructing a museum to be able to house these objects back in Benin City. Again, thousands of these objects exist outside of Benin. And so now the arguments for so long have been that, well, there aren't museums, there aren't institutions that can safely have them, that can safely carry them. But there are now mechanisms and institutions in place that will house these objects in Nigeria.
Chika, I want to come to you on part of what Karen mentioned there around this question of the violent ways in which these objects end up in these European and American museums. Can you tell us a little bit about that history?
Sure. The history of the Benin artifacts is quite precise, simply because it's probably one of the most well-documented acts of colonial looting that took place in the winter of 1897, when the British Navy, under the pretext of what they called a punitive expedition to the Kingdom of Benin, which was the most powerful kingdom in what was called the Oil Rivers, that is southern, today's southern Nigeria, the attempt to seize control of the trade in the region from the kingdom made it necessary on the part of the British to vanquish the Oba of Benin. And they did that in a number of ways, signing bogus treaties and so forth. But in 1896, one of their captains, British Captain Phillips, took an entourage into Benin at a time when he was warned not to enter the kingdom. It was an holy period, but he did anyway. He was attacked, and some of his men were killed. The British then used that as an opportunity to invade, burn down, and loot the palace. But before they went on that expedition, they had already sent word to the Foreign Office in England, indicating that the palace had tremendous treasures, which, if they were taken back to England and sold, could pay for the cost of the expedition. In other words, they knew what they were going to do in the Kingdom of Benin, which was to embark on a military expedition, actualize the goal of empire, and still have the Benin people pay for it by virtue of seizing their treasures and selling them off to buyers, museums, and so forth in Europe in 1898, which was when the government of Britain organized the first auction sale just a year after the expedition. And that's how these objects spread across Europe and eventually the United States.
So that history is so critical and valuable to know, this idea that there was a clear understanding about what that choice was and the ways that it was connected to a particular kind of fiscal calculus. Karen, can you help us to then put that history into a contemporary context and say, why then does it matter for these objects to be returned?
So I think it is a really important point that was brought up. I mean, just about this history that even museums and many of these institutions were part of in Europe were part of the colonizing project, would send letters to militaries asking them to bring back these treasures. And I think, and not just treasures for you know, fiscal enrichment, but really as basically trophies of the conquest, under the pretext that we, the victors, want to learn about those that we conquered.
Chica, maybe I can come back to you here, because I'm interested in whether or not there's any argument for keeping these items in museums. And by museums, I mean museums that are not on the continent. How would these U.S. museums or European museums justify not giving them back?
They've had really several arguments and excuses, all of them really terrible, at best untenable. The first is that they claim that these museums in the United States and Europe, because they are well endowed, must keep the world's cultural heritage for humanity. This was the argument that some of the captains of the industry made in 2002 when they made a declaration arguing against the repatriation at the time of the Elgin marbles, the so-called Elgin marbles from the Parthenon that are presently at the British Museum. They, of course, were defending the British Museum's right to keep these objects for mankind or humankind. That was a major argument that they made. The second one was something that Karen mentioned earlier, which was that, well, you see, these countries, these societies where these objects were taken from don't have the resources to keep them. And so we might as well safeguard them in our fancy museums. But I've always thought that that argument sounded like someone stealing your fancy car and basically arguing that he could not possibly return it because your garage is so crappy. and then demand that until you build a nice looking garage for this fancy car, the car will not be returned. I don't see a difference, you know, from the kind of argument that they've made. And that's why I think, and this point has to be made, the fact that the Nigerians are building a museum is not and should not be the good reason for returning these objects, because it buys into this idea that, well, poor countries don't deserve their stuff back. The principle is what is at issue. The Nigerians or the Africans can decide how they want to conserve their cultural heritage. And by the way, the Greeks built one of the best museums in the whole world, hoping that their Elgin marbles would be returned for the Olympics some years ago. Up till now, they have not been returned. So the argument about building new museums in Africa is really not what we should focus on. Good for the Nigerians that are building their museum, but that is not the reason why these European and American museums can now say, oh, well, now that they have good museums, we'll return them. What of the other countries that don't have the resources to build fancy museums? That is the question.
Oh, I so appreciate that analysis, Professor. And you know, not only that it's a fancy car in the fancy garage, but also that it was stealing the fancy car that made building the fancy garage even possible in the first place. Karen, let me come to you on this, because there's this kind of moment in 2018 where this breaks through in popular culture, in part through the film The Black Panther. Let's just take a listen for a quick second, Karen.
Tell me about this one.
Also from Benin, 7th century, Fula tribe, I believe.
Nah.
I beg your pardon.
It was taken by British soldiers in Benin, but it's from Wakanda, and it's made out of vibranium. Don't trip, I'm gonna take it off your hands for you.
These items aren't for sale.
How do you think your ancestors got these? You think they paid a fair price? Or did they take it like they took everything else?
Karen, I have to say, I know a lot of people are Wakanda forever. I'm actually Killmonger forever. And this was one of those moments. But the very fact that this was in a 2018 film suggests that this has been in conversation long before the summer of 2020. Can you talk about sort of what the long-term movement to repatriate these artifacts and treasures has been?
Absolutely. Yes. Team Killmonger all the way, especially with that scene. And I think listening to that scene also brings up a really important and sore point for museums, which is that, you know, in that scene, Killmonger, who is Black and who is knowledgeable about the history and culture of, well, you know, the fictional Wakanda, but of Africa, knows more than the white British curator who's presenting herself as the expert and the safekeeper of African culture and art. And I think this question about safety of objects, we do know that institutions here in the US in particular have come under a microscope when it comes to the fact that many museum staff, curators are very white, and that Black and African curators are rarely afforded the opportunities to be able to even be able to curate and present exhibits and make decisions about our own heritage and culture. So, you know, when I wrote about this, I just grappled with this question of when Western museums say, well, things are safe, but yet not even giving the opportunity to diversify the space, to create spaces for Black people and Black community to even come and have this dialogue, right? So it's sort of like how for museums to say that they want to have these conversations, that they want to present, you know, these dialogues on all of humanity, and yet they refuse to basically desegregate and basically in include and empower Black people for us to talk about our own histories and art.
Professor Okeke Agolo, on our last moment here, or last minute here, can you just build on Karen's point and say a bit about what U.S. museums need to be doing in this moment around racial justice?
Well, the U.S. museums, as I've said in some other forum, have been behaving like the ostrich. In other words, for them, this is not the problem of the United States. Rather, it's Europe's problem because the colonizing nations are in Europe. But the fact that Germany, which did not invade Benin, decided this year, as you mentioned, to return the artifact, makes it necessary for U.S. museums to step up and tell us what they are going to do about the looted Benin artifacts in their collections.
Thank you so much to both of you for joining us today. Karen Atiya is the Global Opinions Editor at The Washington Post, and Chika Okeke Agolo is a professor at Princeton University in the Department of Art and Archaeology and the Department of African American Studies.
On this week's On the Media, one former NPR editor's grievances are reverberating far beyond a Substack essay. He claims wokeness is ruining the place.
That marginalized people are storming the barricades and dictating that this story happens and this story gets killed and we're going to use this language and not use that language. That's not what I saw.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
Quote, I wanted to write a story about a Black woman who fails a lot. This is what Raven Leilani told the New York Times about her first novel. Luster is the story of Edie, a Black woman in her 20s living in Brooklyn who's making a bit of a mess as she seeks human connection, professional fulfillment, and artistic self-actualization. Edie is indeed a Black woman who fails a lot. But because Leilani does not ask us to adore or reject her Shiro, instead she writes Edie as human, stunningly, recognizably human. I sat down with Raven Leilani to discuss Luster and asked if she would read a passage from the text. The first time she started reading, she flubbed the line a bit.
Sorry, I do that a lot.
But the second reading was perfect.
I've woken up from dreams where my hands are slick with oil and turpentine and lost the inspiration by the time I brushed my teeth. The last time I painted, I was 21. The president was black. I had more serotonin and I was less afraid of men. Now the cyan and yellow come out hard. I need hot water to make them mix. I work with the paint, let the acrylic dry, and when it isn't right, I rework it again. I remain as faithful as I can to scale. I mix 13 shades of green, 5 shades of purple I don't need. My palette knife breaks in two. When it is almost 5 a.m., I have a passable replication of Eric's face, the slope of his nose in the soft red light of the dash. I rinse my brushes and watch dawn come in its smoky metropolitan form. Somewhere in Essex County, Eric is in bed with his wife. It's not that I want exactly this, to have a husband or a home security system that for the length of our marriage never goes off. It's that there are gray, anonymous hours like this. Hours when I am desperate, when I'm ravenous, when I know how a star becomes a void.
The mistake, the correction, the perfection. Author Raven Leilani is leaving breadcrumbs to the origins of her novel. Joining me now is Raven Leilani to talk through Edie's lyrical, complicated journey of failing, flailing, creating, and consuming. Raven, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
So I am struck that the first time that we learn that your protagonist is an artist is when we're actually learning that she isn't making her art or hasn't been making it. Can you tell me about that decision to introduce your the art by talking about not making the art?
That was sort of a core of this project, where I wanted to talk about art making. And in talking about art making, I felt that I had to talk about failure. I felt that I had to talk about doubt, and also what you just mentioned, which is a huge kind of part of making art, which is not making it. I thought it was important to introduce her journey in a way that felt true, especially as it sort of applied to my own life.
So part of what is gripping from the first line of this book is, I've read that you've said that you wanted to write a story about a black woman who fails a lot. And from the beginning, we get that this is going to be a very imperfect Shiro for us in this text. Talk to me about what attracts you to exploring kind of black girl stumbles instead of black girl magic.
Yes, I mean, I feel like the stumbles are also part of the magic. And for me, you know, as I started this project, as a sort of imperfect black woman myself, I wanted to commit that, you know, that reality to the page. I thought it was important because I do think that that dimension of both being human and art making is there's a temptation to neaten it and to make it tidy, and for our heroines to be pristine and to be able to kind of neatly chart their moral allegiances. But for me, I wanted her to have the space to be fallible. You know, that felt freeing to me and necessary. I wanted her to be able to, when she's hurt, you feel that she's hurt. You know, when she's angry, you feel that she's hangry, and that she be able to respond in kind, and that your empathy for her isn't entirely tethered to whether she's behaving well.
I wonder if that pressure is particularly strong for Black Shiros, that the fallibility margin has not been as sort of robust for Black women who are taking up that space on the page.
That's right. And I feel like we have been having, it's sort of been in the ether, you know, when we talk about depictions of women in art and in culture, we talk a lot about their unlikability. And I feel like that conversation is one I've always and often wanted to have around the cultural space that Black women take up, and why I sort of wanted her to be fallible and to be able to make mistakes is I wanted to write against the idea of stoicism. I wanted to write against the idea that to be silent about your pain is virtuous, or that it perhaps would like earn you the benefit of the doubt that you're human. It felt important that she be able to be messy.
And she is messy.
That's human. Yes, she is.
I mean, just to be clear, this isn't just like some, like, oh, all humans make mistakes kind of thing. No, like, straight up.
Oh, yes.
First pages, right? She is messy.
Yes. And I mean, I should say, like, as a writer, that was like, it was partly, it was incredibly fun to write. But that too is important, that not every sort of response be necessarily justified by like the infrastructure that is around her that is like both racist and sexist, but also that she have moments where she is quite in the wrong, as we are.
Something about that does feel more human, right? That we don't explain every poor choice, every messy, maybe bad choice is the wrong way to think of it, but every messy decision as being, right, the inevitable outcome of structural racism or of trauma, yes. But that sometimes we're just, right, making a mess and it's not an oil painting.
Yes, 100%. And I think that too, it runs parallel to an artist's journey, at least for me, the idea that it is trial and error, and the idea that the trial and error shouldn't sort of deter you from trying to move forward or from trying to make progress or from trying to make the thing you're trying to make or be the person you're trying to be. But yeah, that it's part of it. So yeah, that was hugely important as I wrote, and also just incredibly fun.
Spending some time with Edie was interesting and fun, but she's very solitary as a character. Why that choice? Is that just how she came to you?
I kind of have to own up to the fact that, like, perhaps the author is showing through the text in this case, because I am a deeply solitary soul myself, and I think I gravitate toward those stories. But I also, in a craft sense, I wanted all the room to be hers. I wanted that, you know, it's in first person present. I wanted the entirety of that landscape to be her interior. But also this story is a story about a person who is, you know, while trying to make art, and I guess they're kind of intertwined, she's trying to survive. She's trying to eat and pay her student loans. And there's a certain kind of emotional bandwidth that frays when you're sort of in the midst of that grind. And so the kind of situation that she's in, the precarity that she is experiencing, almost precludes that emotional engagement, which was something that I absolutely wanted to write toward.
There is a lot of sex.
Yes.
For me, that's an interesting tension, right? She's very solitary in some ways, but then like she's not all by herself. There's some very interesting, adventurous, messy, in many different ways of thinking about messy sex going on. Talk to me about how that maybe informs the title of Luster or just informed the story you wanted to tell us.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, there are a number of kinds of sex in this book, and some of that sex is still quite interior and solitary, even if there's another person in the room. Part of the fun was being able to kind of show all of those kind of iterations of like emotional engagement. And you're right, it does sort of relate back both the body and like what is carnal, but also with like the act of making art relate back to that title, which took me a long time to find, you know, how to kind of retain that faith in yourself that I'm trying so hard not to use the word luster, you know, how to retain that, you know, that kind of essential want and yearning when you're up against sort of like the sort of hyperbole of the world around you. And that hyperbole is in the sex, absolutely. And in those moments, I get to show Edie in her messy way, seeking out intimacy. You know, at the bottom of the sort of the core of this book is, you know, the sort of need to make art and the need to be witnessed, the need to find intimacy. And she attempts to do that through sex. She attempts to do that through her body in a number of different ways, some which are kind of ecstatic and some which are a kind of annihilation. And I wanted to make room for all of those.
As I was reading it, I was thinking to myself, that hunger, as you described in what you read to us, that ravenous feeling, and whether it is a sexual hunger, whether it is in fact, hunger for food, hunger to create, hunger to be more fully ourselves, that yeah. There is maybe nothing that has over which the world has attempted to assert more control than women's hunger, right? I mean, so much of how we can explain all of world history is that. I'll just say that leapt off the page to me. Did you mean to put that in there? Is there something else you want to tell us about hunger?
I absolutely did. I mean, I think that I'm always going to be writing toward that subject in some way. It's something that I've been preoccupied with for a while. And again, that could be, you know, the author in the text as well. You know, I think that in writing toward how to resolve that hunger, if it's a thing that can be resolved, is a question that I've felt personally in my own life, but also a question that keeps coming up when I talk to, you know, friends of mine who are out there trying to carve out a life for themselves. Not just the question of how to satisfy it, but is like the hunger too much? And you said it. I think often the hunger is sort of relegated to the space of too much, especially when the person who is feeling the hunger is a woman, especially when the woman is a Black woman. And so this project was also an attempt to present that hunger without pathology.
Hearing you speak now, it puts into somewhat different focus this line very early on in the novel, where Edie tells us, you know, in a very sort of straightforward way, my salary is very low, I have trouble making friends, and men lose interest in me when I talk. And just that sort of recitation of the things that are presumably meant to make women, you know, if you're not earning a lot and you don't have a crew of friends and men aren't just enraptured of you, that is a failure of womanhood in some core way. And yet she tells us so early on and expects us to continue on the journey with her.
Yes. Well, I mean, that was incredibly important to me. Like that those facts be presented sort of baldly, but also that it be an earnest text. I think one of the my sort of biggest struggles when I come to the page is resisting the urge to hide behind the prose, resisting the urge not to say the difficult thing. And it's difficult to be able to articulate or to have to articulate that you aren't performing in the way that is acceptable, that you need something that you don't quite have and you don't know how to get it. And that I think that to ask for help is one of the hardest things you can do, to say that, to kind of own what would make you feel good, even when you don't have it in the moment, is an extremely vulnerable thing to do. And that too was like truly what was guiding me is, I wanted to be vulnerable. I wanted Edie as a character to be earnest, especially as her sort of like external kind of maintenance doesn't really allow for that, as she sort of moves through the world and calculates, protects herself in the way she has to as a Black woman. So that sort of earnest presentation of the facts, that too was really important.
Earnest, hungry, failing, exquisite. Raven Leilani is the author of Luster. Raven, thank you for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
Now, what is the social scene that you are most missing over the past year? For me, it is house parties. Kick back in familiar spaces with familiar faces, music, laughter, and very loud, we'll call them discussions. I can't wait for it to be safe for us to all gather again like that. But while we're waiting, we can engage the intimacy, hilarity, and spirit of the house party in a brand new late night show hosted by comedian Sam Jay. A show that doesn't really look or sound like anything else on television right now.
I thought Uncle Ben was a rice tycoon. I didn't think that was a butler. I was like, this is in a suit. This runs rice. I was proud to buy that rice. I didn't know nothing. I didn't even know the narrative. Y'all just threw a hoe. This was a butler slave. This was a rice god to me. That's what I thought.
Okay, so Pause with Sam Jay had its premiere last Friday on HBO. And Jay told me she isn't trying to reach an advertiser-friendly demographic through her show.
Just trying to talk to people that I guess can feel what I'm talking about. I don't know if it's like, you know, ages 35 to, I don't think that's specific for me, you know what I mean? I just felt like these are things that me and my friends talk about. This is stuff, these are conversations that I'm around a lot and are being had. And I wanted to bring some like rawness and honesty to the screen.
And it is raw. Look, in her stand-up, Jay makes bold jokes that often touch on big ideas.
Go to the British Museum, it's huge. I was overwhelmed. I walked in, I was like, holy, because it was wing after wing after wing of stuff, and it blew my mind because I was like, wow, white people stole all this. Stole so much. All this is stolen. That's crazy.
On her late night show, she brings a similar energy, tackling topics that the audience, and maybe especially like us ex-gen Black viewers, might be clutching our pearls and a little surprised to see discussed so openly on television. The premiere episode delves into what it means when Black people are viewed as being too close or too comfortable around whiteness.
It was just the topic we had a lot to say about when it came up in the room. It sparked a lot of conversation amongst us. And I think when we find things that spark a lot of conversation amongst us in the room, then we tend to push towards them because we're like, oh, we're talking about it, or we're feeling divided about it, then it's probably worth exploring.
And interestingly, Jay said that white folks weren't exactly on her mind when she was creating the show.
Not really. I mean, not in the sense of like, oh, how am I going to get them to understand this? I just felt like, you know, you can follow this if you want to like open your mind up a little bit and follow this. And I didn't want to be explaining myself and explaining Blackness. You know what I mean? It was just like, if you're down to listen and you're down to clown, like, come get down. But if I'm being honest, I wasn't really speaking to them.
So if you are down to listen and you are down to clown, Jay is going to do some fascinating things for you. She's more likely, for example, to seek out Black people whose perspectives aren't always highlighted on TV. Like the conservatives she interviews in the first episode.
When you say pro-Black conservative, mm-hmm. What does that look like? I don't think I've ever heard those words put together, let alone have a picture in my head of how that's active.
I'll list it out. I'm a constitutionalist, I'm a capitalist. I mean, when I say capitalist, I don't mean like, oh, like just abolish welfare. I mean like abolish the Federal Reserve. Like I'm a capitalist. So to me, that's conservative. And then when I add my pro-Black lens in front of it, okay, I'm like, how do I specifically apply these policies to the Black community?
I don't interview people. It's not like a profession of mine. So I was like, you know, I am a naturally curious person and I do enjoy talking to people. And so I tried to just approach it more like a conversation than an interview. Like, I didn't really have an agenda. I didn't want to get something out of them. I didn't want like a gotcha moment as much as I was just really curious about them, who they were and why they made the choices that they made. And so I think that made it a little easier on me to navigate the conversation.
And that curiosity, it creates a kind of depth to the show. And Jay's depth is also related to her willingness to be introspective. For example, she speaks frankly about the pushback she received from her own LGBTQ+ community after a joke she made about transgender women.
Just look at my special. I do a trans joke in a way that I thought was on some that was gonna advance a conversation truly in my heart. But to gay, like they look at me as a gay. At the end of the day, I read that's being said, and it's basically like I align myself with straight people. I don't hang out with a lot of gay people.
I can't ask for honesty from others and honesty from the guests and the people in the room if I'm not giving that. And so, I mean, really, that's what it stems from for me, is just being true to myself and true to the things that I want to discuss and I think are important.
In many ways, these conversations that Jay is having on her late night show are an extension of her stand-up. But her comedic voice has also been sharpened by years as a writer for SNL.
Well, I mean, when you're writing for like a show, like you're writing for SNL, then you're writing for the people too, you know. So you're trying to get your voice into Kate McKinnon's mouth and body in some ways. And so in that regard, you have to think more about the whole, where in stand-up, you just got to think about yourself. But when you're writing and casting, you have to think, what is Kate good at? What is AD good at? What is a good role for Keenan? What does Keenan do well? How are they going to score in this? And how are they going to be successful in this as much as how am I going to get the jokes I want to get out and across?
I have no doubt that in the coming years, you're going to hear and see a lot more of Sam J as she continues to rise in the comedy world. But for now, she's feeling good about what she was able to achieve through her late night show.
I already feel like it's a success because it's done and I like made it and I did it. And I'm like, wow, I got to do something that was uniquely me, authentically me, and I got to share it with the world, really. So, yeah, it's happened already. I think anything else that comes of it is like a bonus.
One place you won't be seeing her anytime soon is in a comedy version of Versus, something Jay says she just cannot wrap her head around.
No, I can't. But people want to see something like that, I've noticed. People want to see comics like battle, but I don't really know what that looks like. Comedy is so like individual and like hyper nuanced, you know what I mean? So it's like, what is a comedy battle? Like, how do you judge that?
I'm not sure how you judge it, but I still got to say, I want to see it. Pause with Sam J airs Fridays at 9 p.m. on HBO. You can also watch it on HBO Max. Okay, folks, that's all we have for you today. Really appreciate you being here with us. Remember, if you have any show suggestions or ideas, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at Takeaway. You can also record a voice memo on your phone and email it to thetakeawaycallers@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.